Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Sweet. So this week we're starting off Dear Science by talking about the Amazon rainforest and the huge asteroid that hit the region before it became a thing. So I just want to start off by what did the Amazon rainforest area look like before the asteroid?
Well, so before the asteroid, there were dinosaurs, a lot of them, and they sort of affected the vegetation that grew in the region. That grew in the region. Growed. I've been with my four-year-old for too long. They grew in the region, and so before the structure of the typical forests were coniferous, and the trees were far apart. They didn't overlap. The canopies didn't overlap, and open sunlight was able to get to the forest floor. But about 66 million years ago, this 12-kilometer-wide space rock struck Earth, and the type of vegetation that made up these forests changed quite drastically. So this team of archaeologists found that cone-bearing plants, so conifers and ferns and things like that, were common before the huge asteroid. But after the impact, the plant diversity declined by about 45%, and extinctions were obviously widespread, particularly among seed-bearing plants. So I guess these conifers. So after the impact, the forest developed a thick canopy, and that allowed much less light to reach the ground. Based on their analysis, the researchers sort of propose three different explanations for what changed or why things changed. So firstly, dinosaurs were there, and dinosaurs could have kept the forest from growing too dense by, you know, feeding on the vegetation, by trampling plants growing in the lower levels, and just sort of keeping everything nice and wide and widely spaced and open. Another explanation is that ash that was falling after the impact enriched the soils throughout the tropics, and that gave an advantage to the faster-growing flowering plants that are present nowadays. And the last one is that the preferential extinction of conifer species created an opportunity for these flowering plants to take over. These ideas aren't mutually exclusive, the team say, and all could have contributed to the outcome we see today. But the lesson here is that under rapid disturbances, tropical ecosystems don't just bounce back, they're replaced, and this process takes a really long time. And that's certainly a lesson for what we see today with vast amounts of deforestation in tropical areas.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, obviously right now we've got huge amounts of deforestation. It's not an asteroid, but it's still causing this huge mass change in how our environment looks. Are we going to see a bounce back in a different but similar way?
Well, this is it. So it's obviously not quite as rapid as an asteroid hit, but on the scale of the lifetime of these trees and these forests, this is a rapid change, and it's not clear whether the forest will grow back or something else will take its place.
Okay, so looking at our next topic for this week, we're looking at COVID-19, and it's been around for a while now, and we know that there's quite a few effects that it has on our body, primarily to do with breathing, seeing as it's an airborne disease, and then it's also got some psychological effects, but there's a lot of side effects that come along with it, and they're quite hard to investigate, correct?
So this is, well, what I want to talk about is the side effects due to the vaccines, not the actual disease.
I was also going to say, yeah, because we saw over in Europe with the blood clotting, and that was proving to be an issue for some people.
Yeah, so in mid-March, a few countries in Europe paused the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines, especially those ones made by, I think, the University of Oxford and AstraZeneca, following the reports that some people had developed these blood clotting disorders after receiving the jab. The decisions were based on about 20 million vaccinated people, so a large number of people, much bigger than a standard sort of vaccine trial. And 25 of them, so 25 out of 20 million, 25 experienced quite serious blood clotting, and these were associated with lower platelet counts, and they were resulting in 9 deaths. Later, the European Medicines Agency reviewed these cases and concluded that the benefits of the vaccine outweighed the risks. And most countries have since returned to vaccinations, although Germany has stopped giving the vaccine to anyone under 60 after its own safety monitoring system reported 31 blood clots in about 2.7 million vaccinated people. And this sort of illustrates how challenging it is to prove that a medical problem following immunization is caused by the immunization, the vaccine itself, or by something else.
Because I was going to say, people just get blood clots regardless of whether they're getting a vaccination or not. It's just something that people get, right?
Right. And public health officials are trying to strike a delicate balance. They want to communicate the risks of side effects, even if they're rare. But what they don't want is give fuel to people who are already against vaccinations and hinder the overall vaccination numbers. And it also strikes at this idea that correlation is not necessarily causation. Just because people get the vaccine and then they get sick, there's a correlation there, but that doesn't mean that the vaccine caused the illness. Yeah. So an example of this is that there's an early version of the polio vaccine, which used a weakened form of the virus to generate immunity, and that caused roughly one person to develop the disease for every 2.4 million doses given. And polio was obviously a devastating disease, and they could identify, but the difference here is in that case they could identify that it was the vaccine that caused the illness, because the virus strain used in the vaccine could be isolated from spinal fluid in those cases. But those kinds of tests aren't possible in most other types of vaccines, and the COVID-19 vaccine in particular. And the fact that these events are very, very rare also makes people question whether is it worth risking, you know, 1 in 2 million or 1 in 3 million or something events versus the benefits of not getting polio, and obviously the much higher death rate of polio, of COVID-19. But even the largest clinical trials, so obviously vaccines undergo clinical trials, they're set up to answer the questions about efficacy and to assess the rate of common adverse events, such as injection site pain or headaches or things like that. But even the largest clinical trials are not designed to detect extremely rare side effects, which might occur in, you know, 1 in 10,000 or fewer vaccinations. But now hundreds of millions of people are being vaccinated against COVID-19. So it does highlight even serious, very rare events, such as these severe allergic reactions or blood clots or things like that. So the challenge now is to try and work out which of these events are actually linked to the virus and which are not, and which are just sort of random distributions.
Is it possible?
They're not sure. I think it's going to take a long time. In the United States, for instance, the NIH, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, has begun organizing a clinical trial to understand the allergy risks of COVID-19 vaccines, and especially those based on the messenger RNA. So that's the Pfizer, which is the one we're getting here, and the Moderna vaccine. In Europe, there is a meeting of its Pharmacovigilance Risk Assessment Committee to further investigate rare blood clotting disorders, these clotting disorders found in a small number of people with the AstraZeneca vaccine. And so they're trying to organize and try and figure out ways of working out whether they're connected, but it's not clear. A more complete understanding of vaccine safety could be garnered from active surveillance systems that collect adverse event data, so both background rates and after a vaccine, from electronic health records that don't necessarily rely on people reporting them directly. So the idea that people's health records are held electronically allows you to determine their health status before and after the vaccine, and if they're at risk of these events before, then maybe the vaccine isn't the cause.
Okay, and so our last story for today is around neutrino hunters going underwater to trap ghost particles. And what are neutrino hunters and what are ghost particles and why are they hunting them?
So there's these crazy physicists wearing safari hats and going out into the jungles hunting. No, the neutrinos are these tiny little particles that are almost massless that are flying through us just about all the time. The universe is basically awash with these little tiny things. And they're difficult to study because they interact so rarely with the things that with matter, with the things that with us and the things that are around us. So they virtually ignore us completely. So they pass through us. They don't interact at all. And for the last few years, there's been an effort to study these particles called Ice Cube, which is a big detector that was built in the ice beneath the South Pole. And this big detector has managed to catch a massive 300 detection events in the last few years, which is not a lot. But they're not interested in just regular neutrinos because they're everywhere. They're interested in neutrinos that can tell us something about some of the major catastrophic events that are happening in the universe, like black holes colliding and supernova and things like that. It's possible to trace these neutrinos back to those sources. But in three or four years, they've managed to detect just two and trace them back to where they think they came from. So what they want to try and do is because it's incredibly difficult to do so. The neutrinos have a very, very, very low chance of interacting with, in this case, ice, which is sort of around which light detectors are positioned under the South Pole. And every time a neutrino hits a nucleus in the ice molecules, a little flash of light, it basically gives them a kick, and as the nucleus decelerates, it emits a bit of light, and the direction that light is emitted can tell you something about where that neutrino came from. But in this detector, it doesn't really have a very good accuracy of determining where that position is. And so what they want to do is build detectors that are basically undersea or underwater. So this month, researchers are going to drop sensor strings into the Mediterranean off the coast of Sicily. And these are long strings that contain a series of detectors, light detectors. And they're going to position a bunch of these together, anchor them to the bottom, and basically wait. And the idea is that because water scatters the light a little less than ice, it will be able to, it'll enable them to have a better idea of where these neutrinos are coming from. At the same time in Russia, they're doing a similar sort of thing under Lake Baikal in Siberia, and also the coast of Canada, the west coast of Canada. They're doing another thing in the next few years, the same sort of idea in the next few years. And so what is this going to tell us? Well, this again gives us another way to look at the universe that doesn't involve looking at light. So if we can use, we've already talked about on this show about using gravitational waves as a way to study the universe, the neutrinos that are generated in these sort of massively energetic events can also tell us a lot about what's going on in the universe. And having detectors positioned around the world that have a pretty good idea of where those neutrinos are coming from can allow us to pinpoint, it was coming from this region of space. So they can sort of correlate, we just saw a big flash of light using our telescopes, and we just saw a detection event in our big neutrino detector, and we can sort of correlate the two and say, okay, well, these neutrinos tell us this about this big event in the universe. And so hopefully over the next few years, we'll be able to get a better idea, just like with the gravitational waves giving us more information, these big neutrino detectors will do the same.
That just boggles my mind. I think I only understood maybe half of that. Sweet. Well, that is the end of Dear Science.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Sweet.